The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, Peter. My notes are glued together from walking here in the rain, but we'll see how we go. Should religious people be excluded from the public square? Well, there were certainly growing voices calling for just that. Around concerns, contemporary concerns, on religious violence, on the institutional abuse of children, there are more and more voices saying we've got concerns about Christians in this space. Culturally, Christians are being viewed with suspicion in a number of different places we could think of. Think of the recent Canning by-election. Do you remember Andrew Hastie standing up, being questioned at length about his views on Genesis 1 and 2? Where did he stand? I wish I had question time that good at church when I preached on it. Not just where did he stand, but where did his wife stand? Where did his father stand? And was his faith going to be a problem for him being able to exercise his role as an MP? The very thing that previously potential candidates may have stood on, he's a good church man, was now the very thing that was being used against him. Think of the conversations that took place just recently around the plebiscite and its wisdom, with Shorten suggesting that it would be a lightning rod for speakers of hate to attack and abuse LGBTI people in Australia. A veiled dig at anyone who would speak against, and certainly the churches that have already been speaking against changes to the Marriage Act. But at a more popular level, you see it all the time. So, to quote from yesterday's Telegraph, Steve Martin, writing in there, says that schools should be a place of fact rather than fiction. They should be a place that embraces fundamental learning, teaching students about science, humanity, and human relationships. I think every school in the inner West should adopt the policy of removing religious education. It's the 21st century and it's 2015. So there you go. Now, I'm from the North Shore, not from the inner West. We haven't got it yet. But at least in the inner West, it's 2015 and the 21st century, and they've worked out that it's time for religious education to go. That language of moving on, of progress, is deployed a lot. A bit like the milk container that's found at the back of the beer fridge, and it's sat there for 6 months, and you realise to horror that the contents are separated and that the plastic's starting to swell out. Your duty really is to say that the time has come. We've now seen that the use-by date has gone, and this thing needs to be removed. It's a danger. There's risk if children get into this kind of thing. We must remove it in order to protect people. I think you see where I'm going with that analogy. But talk of religious freedom at the same time is being viewed with suspicion. You say that you're for religious freedom, but that's really a proxy for bigotry. Tim Dick, who's writing occasionally for the Herald on this, keeps raising this. You know, you say it's religious freedom, really it's just proxy for discrimination, for hate speech. The church's values today are at odds with those of the city. We no longer need the Anglican Church, thanks. You know, you were the establishment chaplain to the colony. We did give you the nice sites for the cathedral, but no more. As the city grows, you want land, you can buy it. You're here just as a consumer. You have no privileged position. Freedom of religion, whatever it means, is being whittled back to a freedom of worship. Religious freedom ends at the door of the church, of the synagogue, of the mosque. And once you venture into the public spaces of our city, then you must be treated just like any other citizen or any other consumer. So that's the broad cultural landscape that we're playing in as we consider these things. And in that, the culture is still a little bit ahead of the law. It's not as though laws are insisting at the moment that Christians are out, but the media are asking the questions. Is it right for them to be in? You see that with the Andrew Hastie example. And at the same time, believers, can sniff these winds and are playing it safe. Plenty of churches, of Christian organisations, are doing just that. They know where the bread is buttered. They don't want to get the government offside. They'll be very quiet. I can think of a university group on campus, and it's not alone, who've decided they are just not going to teach their position on sexuality. They know that if they do, there'll be a risk that they'll lose access to the campus, lose registration as a club, be unable to reach the campus, and so they've censored themselves. They still hold those beliefs, mind you. They just dare not speak their name. To find out what gospel they teach, you need to really get behind closed doors. This self-censorship, this tactical withdrawal from the public space, makes for a very safe life because the gospel is not heard publicly. Christians like this are safely unknown in the public square, and they're safely ignored. There's no public offence and there's no threat. But note this, there is some cost to authentic Christianity with that. It's hard not to view that kind of tactical withdrawal as a truncation of the Christian message itself. However much the message may be, Christ is Lord of all, the practice is accepting places that might cause offence. And by refusing to speak their beliefs in the university, they train the next generation of students, of Christian students, for a lifetime of capitulation, of having a private, secret faith identity that really sits at odds with being a citizen in modern Australia. It's the reason I had the reading from Galatians. There's the accusation there in Galatians that Peter is conducting himself in a way which is really at odds with his true beliefs, that in the public kind of issue of dining, who he eats with, what he eats, he's really not conducting himself in truth, in accord with the gospel itself. And I think the danger is there for Christians today to have one set of beliefs which is out there that does not line up with the practice of the faith. Now, these things don't happen in isolation, and at the same time that there are calls for believers to be outside of a right to speak in the public space, the law itself is changing, and there's a blurring of civil law and morality. We no longer can speak of just one Australia, but of a remarkable diversity. But with it, as the experience is throughout the whole West, there's less cohesion, less social cohesion, less agreed values, less obvious kind of common appeal to morality. There's no way that we can say, you know, this is how God would have our city live. There is no common moral framework to appeal to. And you start asking the question, well, what is at the centre of our system? And some of the calls to remove believers from the public space say, well, we don't need it anymore because with all these differences, it's better to go for a neutral kind of language of rationality, put that in the centre. And rationality does give us a common language that can do some good things. You know, we can agree whatever our different religious or irreligious views are on what rationality might do for mathematics, for hard science and so on. But in the real world, how does it help us with issues like how to care for the aged? You know, how does someone with just rational views approach something like that? See, other questions are begged about what it means to be human, about what the good life looks like. And with that, we appeal to all kinds of beliefs, religious and irreligious. You know, a utilitarian might make one argument, a Kantian might make another, a Christian might make another. But it's very hard to see why any one of those views should be privileged in the modern secular state, or how it gives an obvious answer that everyone else should bow down before. All of them are able to contribute to how the good life is to be lived. But that disagreement, that unease about how we get to answer questions like that leaves you just with a law itself left in the middle, being the source of moral legitimacy You know, if we can't agree on a common moral framework, at least I can say the law is on my side. The law shows me to be in the right. The law, to use theological language, justifies me. It will show that I am righteous, that I am doing the right thing. And increasing areas of life that used to be private are now governed by law. Law which is increasingly aspirational, increasingly moral in tone. I think not just of the hard law that gives you all the practice, but also just the way that we self-govern ourselves in life, that we lay all kinds of regulations and rules upon everyday experience. I should have brought photographs of the school gate that my kids are at. I don't need to, because the school gate all through the city is the same. There are so many signs telling you exactly what to do. And at our school gate, week by week, there's fresh memos that come from the principal's office about how the school pickup is to be conducted. And there's this unbelievable regime with laminated cards that need to be shown, and a roster of parents with high-vis vests and clipboards and whistles, and they're marking off names, and there's a shaming of people who don't follow the rules, who don't keep the regulations that we've set up. It's enforced with a passion, with a religious zeal. The public shaming through the school newsletter of recalcitrant Parkers has to be seen to be believed. This calls for repentance and alignment of values, thinking about what it does for the next generation. Won't somebody think of the children? We used to just park outside the school and occasionally annoy the neighbours because we'd park across their driveway. No longer. Now, we want to have law over us to say, I'm in the right. The way that I'm doing this is right, and you must comply with it. These are good times for lawyers. It should seem strange, then, that as we have a growing reach of law, that we also have less sense of law in the democratic state. People have more and more a sense of entitlement. There is nothing above me. We can't agree that God is setting the agenda or that there's a common moral framework. So I become the final reference point. In all kinds of areas, I want to be recognised by the law as the one who has authority in that kind of situation. I was preaching recently at church and had question and answer time after the sermon. And the first question that I got was someone who said, look, I understand what you're saying about the text. I agree that that's what the Apostle Paul meant, but he is wrong. Because he doesn't agree with me. Well, that last bit wasn't quite what he said, but that was the attitude, was the authority really here is not in whatever your sacred scripture may say, but is in me as a reader. I stand over it. I'm the one who judges it. I am the source of authority, and you need to recognise me as standing above it. As we spoke more, it was clear that he recognised the challenge to his authority that the scripture itself gave. There was a clear resentment at the Christian faith, precisely because it would challenge his authority and say that he is answerable to another. And that same challenge is really made to the state. Even if there's an agreement that we're not a theocracy, it's not as though we have Christ in the middle of our political arrangement or anything like that. To the democratic state, the Christian faith is saying that rulers sit under the authority of another. Just as Christ, before Pilate at his trial, said you would not have authority were it not given to you. There is a challenge to the authority structure of the state to say that rulers cannot be absolute. This is a wonderful argument, by the way, against tyranny, to say that there is an accountability for rulers, that they're not free to do what they would have, that they too are under the law, you know, lex rex, that the law is king even over the ruler. And that is a hard message for a modern, secular, liberal democracy to hear. When it's founded on liberty, equality, fraternity, when we say that there is nothing really at the centre, real questions have to be asked about how do believers fit into that. Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, helpfully goes to that liberty, equality, fraternity, and says how that needn't displace believers at all. That liberty actually provides that no one should be deprived of, no one should be forced in the domain of religion or their basic beliefs because of what they believe. You know, we genuinely do believe in freedom of belief. For equality, that people of different faiths can coexist, that there is no privileged position, but neither is there exclusion from the public square, and fraternity, that all spiritual families can be heard in this ongoing process. Now, that's complicated, that's an ongoing conversation for secular democracies to have, but it does raise the question about how democracy itself can function long term without a centre, without a sovereign, without civil religion. The rise of huge migration out of Syria at the moment is raising that question again for Europe. How long will this Western project work, where everything depends on us agreeing to get along together, having a philosophy of civility in the public space without civil religion, pursuing the common good together despite our diversity? The more you think about these issues, the more you realise where we are, the more you need to give thanks for those who've come before us and for what we have. This civility in public life takes hard work, and that's not helped by quick and easy headlines in the Telegraph that say it's 2015, let's get rid of these religious people. To excise religious people from the public square on the basis of their beliefs is fundamentally illiberal. It goes against liberty, equality, fraternity. So, religious freedom and civility in public life. We lose freedom of religion at our peril. The freedom to believe and to live together according to those beliefs is at the very basis of our life together. Having freedom of religion underpins freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of association. A robust state has allowed for that diversity of beliefs. And that discussion is not just an abstract one for people interested in politics to have. It matters because of the way it touches on the real world. Non-profit organisations, charities, religious groups all depend on this freedom, and they in turn promote social harmony and the common good. So right now in Victoria, the Catholic Adoption Agency, which has been running for 75 years, is in a very real danger of having to close down forever because the changes to the same-sex Discrimination Act down there mean that they will no longer be able to act according to their Christian convictions. And the state is saying there's no place for religious exemption. Not here. Equality has to trump your religious concerns. And so it's in the upper house, and the fate of religious liberty in Victoria rests in the hands of a couple of fishers and shooters. That's where we are. Real diversity, true harmony, genuine freedom. Who wouldn't want that? Particularly when the alternative is the growth of a coercive state that decides which beliefs are acceptable and what views may be spoken. So we should be fans of religious freedom. Not because it gives freedom to the religious, but because it gives freedom for all world views. Because it's the underpinning of true diversity. And in a world which is incurably religious, it's essential. It's the best way for us to live together. Having a civil public square, allowing for freedom of conscience and belief for everyone, acknowledging the rights, the responsibilities, the respect that come with it, allowing for civil disagreement. This requires a commitment to work hard to achieve that civility in public life, and the legal profession has a key role in it. We've got to say loud and clearly that freedom for the religious is not cover for bigotry. We need a reopening of the public square, open to all voices. the quote which I've got there from Jürgen Habermas, the German philosopher, not a believer himself, speaks of that, that when religious voices are excluded, it's highly illiberal. But more than that, it's just not practical. It's actually bad for democracy. Freedom of religion like this is never a product of law alone. It's something that's taught as teachers teach students, as parents teach children, as it becomes a habit of the heart. Civic education is something that I think we need to readdress and look to, and it's certainly one of the great pressing projects, the great needs of the hour as we look to the issues which surround us. It's something which needs to be part of the cure for a world of sound bites that would too quickly dismiss the genuine beliefs of religious people. Now, we are going to have a question and answer time. I want to... I was told you never apologise at the start of the talk, so I didn't, but here it is now. It may feel as though I've capitulated completely. I have a Bible here. I barely opened it. I think there was one reference to Galatians and the trial of Jesus, so there were two there that I quickly got in. But I hope in what you've heard this morning, you've heard a response on the terms of the complaints being made against religious people. We haven't opened the Bible. We haven't done the harder work of seeing how the scriptures actually contribute so wonderfully to this debate. But hopefully there's been a bit of stimulation there, and you might want to push back against me on that very issue. Thanks, Ben. Okay, as always for this group, some great questions. Is there a difference between Christians proclaiming the gospel in publicly funded spaces, schools, universities, etc., and other public spaces? Should Christians be excluded or have to comply with certain rules from the publicly funded square? You could say that Christians pay their taxes and give to Caesar what they should, and so there's I'd take away the public funding argument from that. Yes, public spaces are not churches, so there is a difference, and yet I think there's a place there for freedom of speech, which isn't just privileging Christians, but which is allowing genuine interchange to take place. And if we're talking about the universities, then surely that has to be the place where we argue hardest for freedom of speech and are most careful about restricting it. Much better to see the free interchange of ideas take place there. Jermaine Greer faced that very... I'm not sure if you saw that in the press just in the last couple of weeks, where she's challenged some of the rhetoric around transgender issues, and there's calls for her to be banned from the university campus. She's not alone. More and more kind of banning of students take place. There's a step to illiberalism that takes place once you start wanting to monitor which beliefs are acceptable and which are not. So I would push back against that on that. Are there not some voices, though, some worldviews, which shouldn't be heard in the public square? Freedom of speech is not absolute, so yes, we can, the person who stands up now and cries fire and, you know, we all trip going down the steps, yep, there should be consequences for that. There are dangerous beliefs that will be conspiracy, you know, that fall foul of security laws or criminal laws and so on. So freedom of speech is not an absolute right, but I'd much rather know who the neo-fascists are in Australia by allowing them to speak rather than banning any neo-fascist speech. I think it's much better that we put sunlight onto those kind of issues rather than have them in the dark and growing. Although sunlight makes things grow, so I'm not sure how that works. Will our successful proclamation of the gospel in, say, universities and legal community be enhanced by a strong public stance against same-sex marriage as being against God's law, with the risks of an uncivil backlash against that stance? I don't think we get to choose what the scriptures say or how the gospel speaks to our society. It's a given. We are but messengers. The way we speak needs to be gracious. Lead to a backlash on same-sex marriage? Perhaps. You might expect that, but Christians have been in the habit of getting backlash for talking about the resurrection of Jesus and other things for 2,000 years. So let us speak, but let us speak graciously. And particularly with this issue, let us speak compassionately, recognising that people with same-sex attraction are not them out there, but include us. There are people within the church who have this not as an issue for others, but this is their issue. This is the thing that they live with and that they struggle to be holy with. Is there a risk of an uncivil backlash? Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the plebiscite debate is played out, and it's going to be very important that we speak with gentleness and respect. Good question from the Bible. John 19:11. Jesus says Pilate has no authority except what is given from him, from above. Does this include all governing powers? What of Hitler, Stalin, Mao? Jesus speaks that in the context of the greatest evil that's ever taken place in the earth, that the innocent one is handed over, that the Creator comes to this world and his creatures kill him. You know, that evil takes place, and that Pilate allows it, knowing him to be innocent. We should be aghast at that and say, yeah, that lines up with the kind of awful tyranny that, you know, belongs to a Hitler, a Stalin, a Mao. And yet Christ is teaching this very thing of Pilate, just as the Apostle Paul in Romans 13 will teach it of Caesar, you know, speaking there probably of Nero, and in a context where, you know, persecution isn't as full-blown as it's going to be shortly, but knowing that, you know, there is a ruler there who has authority, who's claiming to be divine, you know, and demands the worship of an empire. The scriptures say, yep, the even rulers like that are raised up and are brought down by God and will be held to account for the way that they act, will be judged for their failure to bring justice to their people. There's a much longer answer to that, but that's a start. Why did the mainline Protestant churches surrender to the secular culture? How did secularity come to be seen as the good for a society? They're fascinating questions, and I'd love to know the answer to that. I've got some ideas. I think Charles Taylor, who I cite as one of the very helpful thinkers on it, and a lot of the history is being written so far that connects it to the thought world of Europe in the 17th century. I think the more you look at it, the more you see it actually goes back to the very early church. So one of the very early Christian writers, Tertullian, lawyer, gives us for the first time the language of religious freedom. And as a leader in a persecuted church, is starting to think about what does it mean to be Christian in an oppressive kind of environment. So I want to know more about that. Who will defend pluralism? Well, we all take part in it, and I think pluralism, as I've described it here, is worth us being part of. And I recognise at the same time that another Christian response is saying, let's withdraw. This is all too hard. Let's head to the hills and get into the monastery and ride this one out. The West is not in a happy state. I don't think that's the way to go.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.